The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And the podcast is outdoors. We're at the Vintage Conservatory on King Street on the patio. It is a gorgeous day in September. So if you hear any radiant noise, that's what it is. And I'm joined for the third time with Heather McDougal. Heather, thank you so much for being on the pod.
Oh, such a pleasure to be back. This is always such a fun conversation for me.
I love having you on. You know, when we run into each other, when you're hosting events, you always kick ass. I was going to do the bio like a professional broadcaster, but you do so many different jobs and you've worn so many different hats. Like the first time that we did this podcast till now, I mean, you've done so many different things, which we're going to get into because it reflects what it is like to work in the wine industry. But for the listeners, could you explain what a day or a week is in the life is like for Heather McDougal?
Oh, it is absolute chaos and I would have it absolutely no other way. So I am a certified sommelier, classically trained, came up through the very predictable restaurant and retail pathways. And during lockdown 1.0, started my own business, a company called Sips Toronto, that has evolved into a wine services hub for all things that wine touches. Day to day, I work mostly in private cellar management. So I manage collections between 8 and 22,000 bottles, and those collections are located all around North America. And that keeps me super busy. So I spend a lot of time in basements. Recreationally, I host private educational seminars. I host dinners, tasting menu, wine pairing, just lots of fun things. And then recently I've gotten back into an active roster of restaurant clients because every restaurant needs a wine list that makes money, but not every restaurant needs a wine list to have a sommelier on the floor. So I have a number of restaurants that I work with in that capacity, again, from small to large, and they definitely keep me busy.
So many different angles to go on this. First, do you always keep a sweater in your car, even in the summer, if you know you're going to be in these basements and in these wine cellars?
I left the house this morning wearing a beautiful pair of pink stiletto heels. And if you look under the table, you'll notice that I'm now wearing cellar sneakers.
Yeah.
Right behind the driver's seat of my car that is parked right in front of us, there is a navy blue hoodie because you know that cellars are cool and breezy.
And they need to be. If they're not, that'd be bad. Wait a minute. Hold on. Totally off topic. Did you find parking on King Street?
Loading zone.
Oh, okay. I'm like, is that like the holy grail? What's like the most, and you don't have to give names, but the private clients you work with where you manage their cellars, what are some of the most interesting wines or shocking wines that you've seen? Or maybe some rich person still loves J-Lore, their Yellowtail or something like that. But like, what are some of the odd things you've encountered?
Oh, I don't think I've seen anything that's truly peculiar. I think one of the things that I do when I first start working with someone is ask them what they're into and what they're not as into. And then the first phase of any organization or inventory is a sort. What do I think is still good? What should they keep? What should they sell? What needs to be used for cooking? What can we give to the kids to make sangria? So we find some very interesting bottles. The last one of many, the last few of many, I forgot I bought that in 2007. I'm like, that's okay, no problem. There's a job for that. What I think I love about working with private clients is I work with so many different styles of collectors. Some collect one bottle a month and are super happy to have that addition to their fridge. Some collect cases at a time. And I now have so many different styles of collections that I have really great avenues to sell classic wines, to sell modern wines, to sell low intervention wines, to introduce people to things that they wouldn't necessarily find. So my job now is not so different than it was as a floor som, because you don't need me to find exactly what everyone already talks about. You need me to show you the good stuff that no one is going to tell you about.
Yeah.
And I think that's the fun thing.
Of course, yeah. I mean, there's a Chateau Palmer event going on tonight. No one needs any of us to tell them, hey, Chateau Palmer, not a bad wine, but it's more the funky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Does it ever amaze you when you see someone's cellar and there's so much good wine that's already passed? Like, one of the messages I always give to someone is you don't need to save this wine for a birthday, an anniversary, Christmas, Thanksgiving, whatever. Now, I love having good wines for those events, but for people that have so much wine, I always tell them, listen, make Wednesday special. Open this 25-year-old Premier Cru Burgundy. Make Wednesday a little more special.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think cellaring wine, investing in future pleasure is an absolute must if you're going to join the collector side of life, but at some point your collection gets outside the realm of possible to consume in your lifetime. So for clients like that, when I see a section, usually something that was a big passion of theirs when they started collecting, has gone out of favor, they forget to keep drinking it, then I encourage them to do a dinner around it, invite their friends over. Let's do a few cellar clearing parties and let's get this collection back under control. The other obvious pathway is if you're not going to drink it, then let's auction it off, let's recoup some of the cost, and let's invest in sections that for you are interesting enough to drink, things that you do want to open on Sunday through Saturday.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a good idea. A, the party. I never even thought about that.
Yes. And because wine always tastes better in good company.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Great wine. It's funny. I always say this. Like my girlfriend, she's like, oh, I feel bad. I drink all your wine. And I was explaining to her, my wine tastes better when I'm drinking it with
you. Yes.
You know, and that's a basic fact in life. Also, yeah, with the Iron Gate auctions, or you can donate it, Grapes for Humanity.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different
pathways to kind of clear things away.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I like this quote from your Instagram account. If people want to, usually we do promos at the end, but if people want to follow you, find the websites, what's the best places for people to find
Heather? Sure. You can find my company at Sips Toronto, and the website is sipstoronto.com.
That's easy.
And if you feel more adventurous and you want to follow me personally, I am at High Acid Reds.
That's right. I love this quote. And use wine as intended, a reason to gather and enjoy life.
Truly.
I think that is a great way just to describe what good wine, or even bad wine with good people, is all about.
I think the best wine people in the world have a core of generosity, like built as part of their spirit, and everything else wraps around that. Because anyone who loves wine is so happy to open and share with someone who doesn't need to have all the information, doesn't need to know all the technical stuff, but someone who will appreciate the time it takes for wine to come to the table.
How much do you enjoy it when someone doesn't know what you're pouring? And maybe they know wine to an extent, but they're not like an expert. And you see them take the first step and they suddenly go, oh, that noise and that look when they realize there is something a little more elevated than what I was expecting.
Oh, it is my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Really, it's like watching light bulbs go on above people. Like when you're teaching and you present a concept in a way that someone understands, and then you see them kind of think about it, mull on it, roll it around, and then go like, oh, no, I get it now. Mm-hmm. I get why people freak out about this stuff. Understood.
Yeah, it's cool. By the way, speaking of sharing, you opened a really beautiful wine. I was wondering if you could tell people what are we drinking? I'm trying.
Yeah.
Oh, 2015. What Saint Julien do we got here?
Amazing. So this is Le Petit Lion. So this is a wine from Léauville Las Cases in Saint Julien, one of my favorite chateaus in Bordeaux. Fun fact, my dog is named Leo after Léauville Las Cases.
Such a nerd.
I am such a nerd, and I don't hide it at all. I think it's one of the most charming things about me is that I can get so excited about the smallest thing, because this really does bring me such joy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Le Petit Lion is a wine that comes from the property. It is modest, it is balanced. 15 was a great year for them. Like in the glass, this is so much more friendly than I anticipated it being, and it really is starting to push forward with that like pencil shaving granite smell, which I really love.
It's classic Bordeaux. And I was wondering, I didn't know it was 15. I wouldn't have guessed, because 15, big year, a little bit warmer. So it could have been bolder and still a little bit tight, but this isn't. Like, you just poured it in the decanter. This thing's drinking beautifully.
Yeah, I love it. So even though it's unfashionable to drink Bordeaux right now.
Okay, what is it? It's weird to say this sentence. I feel bad for Bordeaux. Everyone must state they like, if when you have to choose between Burgundy and Bordeaux to get all the cool person wine points, you need to say you like Burgundy more than Bordeaux. Why is it Bordeaux sometimes just gets this bad reputation?
Well, Bordeaux kind of did it to themselves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Burgundy is so much more easily relatable to people because it's farmers and it's dirt and it's clear terroir and clear definition, and Bordeaux is suits and export directors.
Fair.
And
yeah.
Lunches. So if that vibe is not your vibe, if you're not immediately welcomed into that club, if you don't feel comfortable in those rooms, then it will be a little bit more difficult to make friends with Bordeaux.
The funny thing is it's actually easier for tourism to do to see Bordeaux. Burgundy, like, get the hell out of here, we don't want you. But Bordeaux, which, as you mentioned, is the land of giant insurance companies now owning historic properties.
Yeah.
It's much easier to go.
But even in Burgundy, it's so much easier now to be a tourist than it was a decade ago. like that there is so much more support for visitation, mm-hmm. and it's no longer one hotel, one bakery, two churches per every little town. Like there's a nice bread vending machine in Nuit Saint-Georges that you can get a baguette at any time of day after you stumble out of the wine bar there.
Now I got to go back. Last time I was there was actually in 2015.
Time to go back.
Yeah. Hard to convince my girlfriend always says we need to travel to new places. We went to Bordeaux for a second time only because I did the marathon.
Oh.
It was the only way I could convince her. It's like if I run 42 kilometers, we're allowed to travel in Saint-Emilion for a bunch of days.
That's nice.
First time you came on was my 10th episode, and that was on... that was like April, that was spring of 2018 when you were in charge of Montecito.
Yeah.
Which, up and down, I miss the glory days of you and Montecito.
Me too.
That was an incredible place for wine. Then the last time you were on, August 18th, 2020, where we just had a long conversation about restaurant, about the service industry, and you had great advice. And as I said, it was a thoughtful, passionate approach to how restaurants can improve. So it's been 5 years since you've been on. What have been some of the highlights, lowlights, struggles, and successes? It's a tough question because you can go in so many places, but I just want to sort of catch up a little bit. What's been going on with Heather?
Yeah, restaurants will always be part of my makeup. Service will always be in my blood, but there was a time where I kind of fell out of love with restauranting because everything that was happening in that ecosystem made it really difficult to find joy under such constant immense pressure from all sides. Mm-hmm. So I had to take a little break from restauranting. I declined opportunities on the floor. I focused more on building my business, which I had kind of just started the last time that we spoke. Oh. Life has taken me in a different direction, and now it's starting to circle back. Will I ever be on a floor full time anymore? I hope not.
Yeah.
But
it's a hard job.
I am blessed to have guest shifts at places to keep those muscles working. I competed in the Fine Vintage Somme competition a couple weeks ago.
We're getting there.
So it was nice to be in a restaurant setting doing that because a lot of events that I host are in private homes now. So it was nice to be part of the team and do the pouring and talking to the service team and liaising with the kitchen and making sure that everything was coming out as it should. So those muscles still exist. With my most recent client, it looks like I'm going to be a little bit more actively involved again on the floor, maybe not full time. Let's hope. It's not part of my everyday anymore, but it will always be the high of service will always be the most difficult drug to quit.
Because when you make people happy, when you have that great moment and they're happy and they're hugging you at the end. Yeah, it is. It's like what I compare it to is when I used to do stand-up comedy. I came from a theater background. When you do a play, that's well, and you get the applause, that's great. But when it's stand-up and you've got that room and you've got the 18 people all or 48 people
yes.
or 200 people
yes.
laughing. That is the ultimate high whenever I did performance was that.
Yeah, it is not so dissimilar.
Yeah.
I did 12 shows with In Poor Taste, a traveling wine-focused comedy show in December.
In Poor Taste.
It was amazing, and it was so much fun. From those two fellas, I learned so much about the structure of comedy, because obviously I had a role to play. I was their nerd for hire, and I had some things I had to say, and some of them were fun, and they were so great to work with because it was so easy to vibe with them and kind of joke with the audience and have fun that way. But the times that I had listening time, it was interesting to see how they structure their sets, because it's not so different than how I structure wine dinners
mm-hmm.
and how I teach psalms to talk to people like people, not like wine people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Because
it's
an entirely different approach.
Yeah. And doing theater, doing comedy, doing improv,
yes.
it teaches you to be active listener. It teaches you just so many things that actually can help just with daily interactions
yeah.
with people. That must have been nervous for you when you started to do your own business. Because now you're on your own. And as tough as restaurants are, at the very least, someone else is the boss. Someone else is dealing with economic issues.
Yeah.
Now you're the everything. That must
have
been, especially during parts of during COVID.
Listen, I think it takes a special type of person who is a little bit crazy to decide on a business instead of a job.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that even on my most challenging days of self-employment, I am happier doing this than I ever was working for someone else.
Right.
And I think the things that I have learned over the last 5 years, I would never have learned. And now I'm at a point where business is stable, business is growing. There's a team that works around me. There's support there. Like, it's not just me white knuckling the world of wine on my own. Like, there are now a lot of people who help make this dream work.
I don't know if you want to mention any restaurants. You can, you don't have to, but I was just wondering about like some of the recent experiences, some advice or tips you would give to restaurants in terms of how to use wine to be able to make the restaurant financially successful.
Listen, I started by saying not every restaurant needs a somm, but every restaurant needs a wine program that makes money. And I think whether you have a somm on the floor or not, you need to look at that document and make sure that it is bringing everything that it should bring. It should make you money and friends at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it should be costed well that you're making money, but not too high so you're making friends, right? Because every restaurant wants you to be a regular. And you can shear a sheep 1,000 times, but only slaughter them once.
That's a good expression.
It's very, very old.
Yeah.
It came from one of my very early mentors when I was just a little baby waiter.
And I do wonder about that. Like, I guess the certain restaurants out there, the Jacobs of the world.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what they charge because they're going to have their clientele base that doesn't bat an eye when it's 5+ times. But I always wonder that 5+ times what the bottle costs, what the markup is. And I do wonder how restaurants, ones that aren't that, how they come to that price, either by the glass, by the bottle. I mean, I have no problem paying, but even I have my threshold. I'm like, wait a minute. You can't expect me to pay that for that.
Exactly. And I think that's why if you're a small restaurant working with agencies who are also small, so it's not as easy for your clients to price check, and working with a wine professional who can taste a wine that is $17 and go, oh, that tastes like $22, mm-hmm. that's a good one for us to make a little more on because it over delivers on value, right? Because when we talk about cost of goods, we look at that as a percentage, right? This is what we want this program to deliver. I don't see a budget as a savings plan, so I'm not, let's raise the prices. I see it as a spending plan. How much money can I leave on the table mm-hmm. and have everyone happy?
Yeah.
The owners of the restaurant, my clients, myself, the agents that I work with. Like I think sometimes we think too restrictively, like, oh, we have to mark this up by 4 times. I'm like, do we? Do we really? Is there another way to arrive at the same destination? And the answer is yes, there definitely is.
Is there certain producers, regions of the world that you would say, this is a great, this consistently over delivers. Like you get a red or a white from here, it's going to, even if it's $20, it's going to taste like $28.
Let's talk about that question in kind of 2 different ways.
Sure.
You will always be handsomely rewarded by going off the beaten path. So anything that is not prestige region with prestige association is always going to be better value. Mm-hmm. Secondly, $20 is a difficult price point.
Impossible. $20, that's more by the glass. For a bottle.
So I think what not everyone understands is how liquor is managed when it comes into this province, right? So LCBO does all of the ordering, consolidating, shipping, they bring it in, and for anything that goes into agency, it goes into the consignment warehouse up at Trillium. So that comes in, it gets the 70%+ LCBO markup to handle all those things and a little something for the government, because we have to acknowledge that we have a monopoly system here, and mm-hmm. all of that goes to fund healthcare and roads and all of the fun things that we all like to enjoy, all the traffic cones that I sat next to and behind today.
Yeah, by the way, funding roads, you could get some of the construction done quicker.
If we brought California back, it could be done next week.
There
but that's another conversation.
Yes.
So there's obviously the LCBO fees that come on. And then when it goes to an agency, they add their markup to sustain their business. So a $20 bottle of wine, not a lot of that is spent on grapes and winemaking and that, right? So it coming through private agencies, which typically have more interesting wines, that's difficult. So we have to now look, because everything is more expensive, that $20 wine 5 years ago is probably closer to $25 or $27. And that definitely changes how we can use that in a private cellar and on a wine list. Secondly, the LCBO, their buyers in some categories, and I'm going to shout out the buyers for Greece right now, mm-hmm. they do an amazing job of the under 25 buying. And I do have to disclose that I did some work with Wines of Greece this summer.
Yep.
And I have another event coming up. They're not paying me to say nice things about them. I went, I tasted, I saw, and just like I always do when I'm sitting at tastings, I'm trying to find the wines that I love shipped to my house. And so many of them were already in our system.
Xenomarva is one I always recommend. If you love Barolo, that's always one that I recommend. I find you can find enough similarities and far, or at the very least, it's going to taste like a really well-made Nebbiolo d'Alba.
Yeah.
I find that's but for far less a price.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And their aromatic whites, like, can't be beat, really, mm-hmm. truly.
So let's get in. Oh, actually, one other thing on this. Do you see more, just because of tariffs in California and Trump and all that, how much more do you see an uptick in the more local wines being consumed? More Ontario, Niagara Peck, more BC in the Toronto restaurant scene? Because I'll tell you, and by the way, thank you for pouring. This is a delicious Bordeaux.
Very welcome.
I can tell you, I'm now buying far, far, far less Burgundy white. I think Ontario Chardonnay can fill in most of those gaps.
Yeah, I think what we expected to happen was to have those sales immediately divert, and they evaporated.
Yeah.
We didn't really know where they went for a while, and they're starting to come back a little bit, so we're seeing a little bit more strength in some other countries. I think a lot of the top-end sales are lost in the province here, and they have found their way to other provinces. Now, at the more entry-level price points in that $20 to $30 range, and I definitely have seen more Ontario inclusion on lists, but I still think it's difficult to convince people that we do a great job here in Ontario.
You're right.
So many people have this perception of 20 years ago where, yeah, the reds were a little more thin and a little bit more stemmy, and some of them forgot to include fruit in the fermenters, and they kind of reflect that, and they were definitely expensive. And like, just like BC, we can't do great wines on the inexpensive side. Like, we have to be in that $25 to $30 range because we're paying startup costs. We pay living wages. We cover medical expenses. We offer a lot of things that a lot of more established wine regions maybe don't have. So I think when we look at the cost of a bottle, we also have to look at that fully indebted cost. Now, there are great single examples of wines in that like $20 to $25 range, but I think to do a great job, you have to be in that $25 to $30 range.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll happen in my lifetime. I would like to live in a world where no Canadian blinks about Batchelder wine that's $60, but maybe is $195 at a restaurant. It's like, well, that's going to still be as good and be far less expensive than the Jambu Musini. I'd like to live in that world.
Like, I think everyone should be a little bit more curious and go and visit Richmond Station. Is on their reserve list. They've done such a great job of curating a Canadian-heavy section of library releases from a lot of their producers, and it's really cool. Like, having participated in a lot of tastings featuring more mature wines from Ontario, like, I am so confident they age so beautifully, and I'm happy to put my hand up and say, if you don't think Ontario makes great wines, it's okay to be wrong, and let me show you what you're missing.
It's so right. I did a tasting of Flat Rock. They're 10 to 15-year-old Pinots that were drinking beautifully.
Yeah.
I just bought a case of their 2022 Pinot because I know that wine is going to be great for the next decade. One of my favorite wines of this last year was Ice Cellars, and it was a Bordeaux blend.
Yeah.
And it was so big that a 55-year-old man who only drinks Brunello would have loved this wine. Would have absolutely loved that wine. All right, that's my normal rant. People that listen on a regular basis, they hear that all the time. Apologies. Okay, so let's get to this. Take us back, round one of Sommelier Showdown a little while ago at Black and Blue Toronto. And who wins? Heather McDougall wins. Tell us about that event.
It was so fun. And I'm so glad that I said yes to doing it because I was very much on the fence. In the last 5 years, I've kind of walked further and further away from being around wine people all the time. That now
you do such a great job whenever you host an event.
Of course, but it's different than like doing it with the expectation of like being similar to my competitor.
Right.
Right? Because my style started out lightly feral, has remained lightly feral, and sometimes is a little too spicy for people.
Mm-hmm.
So I really struggled with the decision to do this because it puts me in community and in competition with people that I hold in very high esteem, but who have a very different way of engaging with wine. And I think it's really difficult to be different in a business where classic and testable is our North Star.
Right. Yeah, Very fair. But I remember last year when you were hosting the VQA event, you were great at that. Okay, so how do you prep for a Somme competition?
Oh, this was actually the easiest one because I got to taste all the food. So they had us in like 3 or 4 days before the event. We were able to taste through the whole menu, and I was up against Clément, their in-house Somme, who is just this amazing French little whippersnapper who is from Bordeaux and is so Bordeaux proud, and he's such a little nerdling, and he was so fun to taste with because I don't have an attachment to winning. I just need to not lose. Every time I tasted a dish, I was really vocal about what I was thinking about for the wine that I would pull. Like, I didn't say I'm going to do this, but I'm like, tasting this dish, here's what I'm thinking. Like, here's my deciding factor. Here's my supporting things. And we didn't get to see each other's wines until the day of the competition. So he rocks up with his, I rock up with mine. And it's beautiful to see that we solved the same problem differently.
Do you remember what your food and wine pairing was?
For sure. So the first course was fresh oyster mm-hmm. with...
Let me guess. Syrah. Wine jokes.
No. Fresh oyster topped with beef tartare that was very acidic. There was wasabi and soy, and it was like very salty, savory. So he went with a yuzu sake pairing, and mm-hmm. I did a rosé lambrusco. Because mm-hmm. that dish to me, because it was so savory and it was so salty, the wine needed to be fruity. The wine needed to have a little bit of residual sugar because that dish needs something. It needs that little bit of curve. And it also needed acid. So I faked it. I snuck in the residual sugar under the hidden bubbles that act like acidity. And that was our first pairing.
And then from there?
From there. Next course was a halibut dish. So halibut on top of a pea puree with spinach, parmesan, lemon, drizzled in olive oil, topped with a wasabi aioli, beer foam, and crispy shallots.
And what'd you put with that?
So for me, I tasted that dish, and I'm like, the deciding factors are the yeastiness of the beer.
Okay, yeah.
And the texture of the fish. Right? Like halibut is a nice textural fish, but it doesn't have a hugely assertive flavor. There's only a little bit of butter used to cook the fish, and the sear was like very light. So I didn't need anything with oak, right? Because I only bring oak into the equation whether it's something like actively toasted or roasted, and I need that little bit of extra support. But I knew I needed a grape that sat roundly on the palate. So I was chewing on a lot of different things, and I ended up with a Pinot Blanc from mm-hmm. Germany.
Okay.
Right? So that extended lees contact neutral barrel gives me the tie-in with the beer foam. And then the roundness with still like super bright acidity gives me enough balance for the acid in the sauce and a really nice texture mash with the fish.
So this competition was the two of you going head-to-head.
Yeah, four courses.
Four courses, food-wine pairing, and then the judges.
Oh, the judges were the audience, and that's what made it so much more fun.
Okay, So
the wines would drop on the table. Food would arrive. They would have 5 minutes to taste back and forth. They were asked to vote. After voting was concluded, we would get to speak to our pairings. So they had already made their selections by the time that we spoke. And I think that makes it very challenging because I'm a very charming person. So I had to like make sure my pairings were really good because I couldn't get to sway them with my winning personality.
Right. So yeah, you're at a disadvantage.
and you
still won. And so then what's next for you? The grand finale is November 17th?
Yeah. So there's another qualifying round. And
October 20th,
I think
is the next
Jules
one.
Jules and Christian. And then whomever wins.
But Jules Garden?
Yeah.
Jules Garden against Kristen.
From Harbor 60.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
And by the way, this is all, if people want information or get tickets, can people go to this event?
Absolutely. They can buy tickets from the Fine Vintage website.
Okay. Okay. So that next one is on October 20th. Also, and I'm going to try to get this podcast out before, there's another CAPS event coming up, like a blind tasting challenge on Tuesday.
Oh, CAPS Cup. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What's going on with that?
Yeah. So it's an event that we've been running for a long time now, and it's just it's a friendly blind tasting challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So we have three locations running this year. We have Niagara, Toronto, and Ottawa. So we can include anyone who is curious. And we encourage everyone of every ability to come and blind taste these wines, register your guesses. We write the test in a way that whether you're training with CMS or WSET, it is fair questions, mm-hmm. structure-based, style-based winemaking. So it's, don't be dissuaded if you only study from one book and not the other. We're inclusive. Come and join us.
I realize I should have gone back a step. CAPS, of course, the Canadian Association of Professional Sommeliers, for anyone who doesn't know. And you're obviously your board member there.
Yeah.
What's your role with them now?
So I did 5 years as the technical director.
Yep.
And then this year I am handing my crown to Christian. Mm-hmm. Because he's going to take up that mantle. Because unfortunately, the bylaw says my time on the board is almost done. So I'm finishing my tenure as the hospitality liaison. So you will still see me at all of the hospitality-focused events and most of the CAPS events. But yeah, he's taking up the mantle of competitions now, which is so great.
That is cool. Yeah, Christian's been on the pod.
Yeah.
By the way, shout out to them. I love what they've done at Harbor 60. The amount of Canadian wine there now versus what it was 15 years ago is night and day. That is... it's a place maybe you can only go once or twice a year, but it is well worth it there.
Yeah, and I love the amount of animal print.
Yeah. Of course you do. By the way, what's the website? People want to find more information on the CAPS stuff and for the blind tasting challenge.
Oh, the CAPS website.
Oh God.
That's
a
quiz question. I don't know.
I am so sorry. As you are answering that, I also want to talk to you about being a national judge for Canada's 100 best restaurants.
Yeah.
I threw that down in my notes as well. You know, we'll get into that. But like, also for your next event, the final. Will you do any prep for that, for the Somme Showdown on the 17th of November?
Prep? Well, I think we'll get to taste the menu again, which is great. Mm-hmm. I will pick some wines and probably have a Manhattan before the competition starts.
Okay.
Right, because by the time the competition starts, the decisions have already been made.
Right.
So
that's
it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you don't get nervous or anything doing the when you're up.
Oh
there.
No, I think at this point, the only thing that's nervous is being different in front of a bunch of people who know me.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because a lot of the people that I work with for dinners and events, they're not wine people. They're private clients. They're friends of theirs. They're their families. So it's very nerve-wracking to be noticeably different in front of a room full of people who actually know me.
Right. Yeah. And by the way, I can always insert in the end the CAPS website.
Oh, perfect. I found it, by the way.
Or anything like that. I just, wanted to give a shout out. I mean, CAPS does such great work, so I want to make sure to promote.
The website is on.sommelierscanada.ca.
Perfect. You'll be on again in less than 5 years. I feel pretty good about that. What does success look like for you the next, say, couple of years? Like realistic success, where you're happy, where you feel invigorated and just, you can wake up most days and go to bed most days feeling happy. But what does that look like in terms of work?
It looks kind of like doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. At this point, there is enough regular business that I have people who work with me in this business. And over the next few months, that's going to increase again because I keep saying yes to projects that really excite me. And every time I say yes, I'm like, oh, should I have said that yes? Should I have done that? Because at this point, I really only say yes to things that really, really excite me.
Mm-hmm. That's a good place to be.
Yeah, no, it's really fun because I'm at the point where I can choose how to spend my time.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be nice maybe next year to go on a vacation, not a working vacation.
When was the last time you went on a vacation?
2019.
2019. Before COVID.
Yeah, but I honestly regret nothing because I have seen so much of the world wearing my work hat in the last few years. It's been outstanding. I've been to Austria and Rioja and Greece. I'm going to Argentina next year. Like super high on my hit list is South Africa.
You're going to love it. Wine tourism in South Africa is incredible.
That's what everyone says.
It's ridiculous. The crazy thing about Stellenbosch, and that's the only region I was in, so I can't comment on the others, is everything, like so many places are big and opulent, but yet everyone in there is so down to earth. You know, it's a place where there's giant columns. I'm like, hey, come on in. Let's try a bunch of wines, And I had an incredible time there a bunch of years ago. I think my favorite moment, though, was hanging out with Ken Forrester.
Oh, cool.
When Ken said, Matt, do you want more duck? And I'm like, Ken, I've been waiting my whole life for someone to ask me that question. The answer, of course, is yes.
Yes, please. I do.
Yeah. Yeah. What are the projects that you have been approached or that you're saying yes to that excites you the most?
Well, one I was very reticent to say yes to. And like it, I had to do a lot of walking my dog and thinking about this before I said yes. And it's one of the restaurants that I just started working with because it's a style of restaurant that I haven't done in years. And it's a supportive role to build out programming, to work on training. And the more I talked to the ownership group, the more I was convinced that it was too good to be true. So mm-hmm. I almost talked myself out of doing it because I couldn't imagine an ownership group that was so keen to write giant checks for not only me, but for all the programming I wanted to put into place, for education, for training, for opportunities, for all of the things that you get to do when you're a large restaurant. You have the capacity to redefine what not dining looks like, but what restaurant culture looks like.
In the end, I'm rooting for you because I fell in love with Montecito. And I fell in love with it because of you and because of your wine program and everything that you did and the different deals and you had this and stuff for New Year's. And just, I mean, it was inclusive. And it was this great environment for people that love wine. It was a great environment for people that were new to wine who wanted to learn more.
Yeah.
It was this wonderful, safe space I absolutely adored. And obviously, that's what you're continuing to do at all the restaurants or the private events.
Yeah, and it's so great. So many of my most favorite regulars from Montecito turned into private clients, and I still see them all the time for events, and it just makes my little heart so happy because one of the things that I thought I was leaving behind when I chose to not focus on restaurants was the personal relationships. But as it turns out, I didn't have to trade that. I just had to evolve how I thought about it because I'm still involved in people's anniversaries and birthdays, and I'm now buying birth vintages for their kids and for their grandkids, so I'm still part of the family.
You must like it when you get photos from these private events where they open up some wine and them smiling or them showing you the bottle. You must love that.
Oh, I honestly, it is one of the best things that I get to do mm-hmm. is share what I love with people that I adore. And to see them so happy and so engaged and like, oh my goodness, I never knew I would like this. This is so exciting. Can you believe that we picked this up on this family vacation? So now I'm like booking vacations for families. There's one family that I work with that they always do a dinner on Boxing Day. Mm-hmm. And on Boxing Day, they announce to the family where the family vacation is going to be. So the last three have been wine themed. So I'm there doing the dinner. I kind of drop clues and then they get to guess. And then the big reveal, we're going to Tuscany. We're going to Argentina. Yeah. We're going to, it's just so fun.
One last time, where do people go to get more information on Heather McDougall?
Oh, you can find me at Sips Toronto on Instagram, at High Acid Reds if you're feeling bold, and through my website, sipstoronto.com.
Heather, thank you for the time. Thank you for the Bordeaux, and appreciate you doing the pod today.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matchbox Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, on iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.